That's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour for the first time in the year 2012. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. And today, on our first show of 2012, we're going to talk about our resolutions for 2012. We're also going to get into a topic we're calling pop culture overload, which is, if you're a fan of something, how much of a completist do you want to be? It can get awfully difficult to consume everything there is to consume. So we're going to talk about the issue of overload. And as always, we will finish up the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's introduce you for everyone who missed the show throughout 2011. Here is the lineup for 2012.
Hi, Mom.
Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
Well, I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I'm the movies editor at NPR.org, and I occasionally write a bit.
Yes, you do. Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, I'm very, very happy, as always, to see all of you. We've been away for a week, so we're back around the table again, and hopefully we have not lost a step. So let's talk about our 2012 New Year's resolutions. Now, we're not just talking about, you know, the obvious ones. We can be inventive and but pop culture oriented. We're not going to trouble you with our desire to keep our houses clean and balance our checkbooks.
All right, I got one. I have to go first here because you've already done it twice. I resolve that in 2012, I will say 2012, not 2012.
Oh, she said it like 16
because
times.
Because it is time that we as a nation figure out how to handle this century, and I hereby pledge to do my part.
I have been passive-aggressively correcting Linda without telling her every time she does it. She says 2012, and then I'll be like, yes, well, in 2012, I plan to.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad to know we've gotten off on this particular note. How I like to start every show.
By haranguing.
In the new year.
Great.
Yes.
If you're not lucky, I'm going to start calling it Ought 12.
Awesome. That'll be great.
2012.
So how about you, Glenn? Are you going to start the year off by finding fault?
Well, I got reservations about resolutions. I always have. I'm one of those people who feels that resolutions were ginned up by the local news industry to give them something to kill time on the air.
Yeah.
See also staycations and sexting. Not real things.
Oh, boy.
Glenn has a real thing about staycations.
I hate them.
But
before we get to mine, which aren't really that great. Let's go to some old ones that were not really that great. Stephen,
yes.
Last year at
this is horrible.
Would you like to?
This is all about finding
this
fault.
This is public shaming is what this is going to turn into.
I don't think so. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. I went back and listened to last year's show of resolutions, and so I have here in my hand a list of what everybody
Root
said.
Root for Green Bay Packers and buy home arcade systems.
Neither of those showed up.
The rats.
What you actually said, Stephen, last year was that you were going to read a second
book.
How'd that work out?
I've met that resolution a tiny fraction of the way there. I did purchase the book that I intended to read. So really,
And I just want to point out that I did try to help Stephen complete this resolution. I gave him a book about the Packers.
Yeah, wow.
Because I thought maybe if you give him a book about the Packers.
To remind everyone,
there was a specific book, wasn't there?
Well, to remind everyone, your first book was The Hunger Games.
I'm super glad I read.
Yeah. And then you said you'd read a second book, any second book. I assumed you meant the second in the series that you had begun, but apparently you abandoned that and were going to go for A Visit from the Goon Squad, if I recall.
Correct. I have acquired it. I have also acquired Catching Fire and Mockingjay. They sit as dust catchers on my bedside table.
Forlornly on your table.
All right. You also said you were going to cut out some bad TV. You were going to cut out The Bachelor. But then you backed off of that within 30 seconds of saying it when Linda shot you some wounded looks.
Right. That indicated that she would like to watch episodes of The Bachelor. Well, the thing is, you know, Linda and I are both big believers in true love.
Mm-hmm.
And once Linda reminded me
that you can look for it almost unceasingly on network television.
Right. And so I have continued to watch The Bachelor. I did, however, in 2011, stop watching American Idol.
Mm-hmm.
It seriously is one of the best things I've
and
I
you
did all
and
year.
You pretty much abstained from the X Factor,
other than the first two episodes, which I watched for you people listening at home.
Right, that's right.
It was entirely a sacrifice for
you
people
hard.
At home. I did not watch The Voice, did not watch the X Factor,
right.
Did not watch American Idol.
The last thing you said was you were going to add good shows into
right.
the mix, specifically three good shows that you wanted to add.
Wow, I was very ambitious.
You were. First one was Friday Night Lights.
I've watched the first five episodes of Friday Night Lights, and I love them.
Okay, you would watch the first two episodes a year ago. Parks and Recreation.
I have watched 5 or 6 episodes of that, and also loved it. And I own all these things on DVD. I have acquired them.
Right. That was not the resolution.
So somewhere, maybe my pop culture resolution should be to watch the things I acquire.
There you go. Last one, Modern Family.
Not watched it at all.
Okay. Mm. So what is your resolution that is certain to be doomed this year?
Well, I think clearly you've just laid them out for me. I'm going to read a book. No. Knowing that I had failed on at least some of my resolutions, I decided to be more opaque this time around and go for things that I could say I did without having actually done them. I wanted to go for something a little bit more general. I'm not a big fan of sort of holding off on doing something you should do until a certain date. Mm-hmm. Self-improvement, when I do choose to pursue it, tends to be inspiration and sudden realization, epiphany-based, I tend not to schedule my epiphanies. But culturally, what I want to do more in 2012 is just, the word I kept coming back to is more. Mm-hmm. I want to listen to more music. I want to watch more movies. I want to watch more TV. I want to read more books. I want to spend less time with people.
Talking my language.
I want to push the boundaries of what I consume and just embrace as much stuff as possible. Now, because my work life and my personal life kind of dovetail in this thing where I have to write about music for a living, it's sort of both a personal resolution and a work resolution, is just to dive headfirst into as much stuff as possible. And it's a perfect time of year. I'm very fortunate in that I go to South by Southwest every March, and that is just an absolute just feast of music discovery. And in the weeks and months leading up to South by Southwest, there's a lot of just pounding down thousands and thousands of bands. And I just, as much as possible, my resolution is to embrace as much as possible, hear as much as possible, experience as much as possible, so that, if nothing else, I have more things to talk about on this podcast.
Okay, there we go.
Also, I would like the Packers to win the Super Bowl.
Yeah, right, okay.
But if they do not, I pledge to swallow defeat with stoic grace.
Good then.
I don't believe that for a minute.
Just like you.
Trey Graham, last year you had just the two resolutions. Yeah. The first one was to actually see all 10 Oscar films. Did you do that?
Did not.
Okay. Even I did that.
I know. I think I missed it by what, 2? I can't remember.
I can't remember either. Your second one was to, quote, follow through on crap, end quote, which was really just an excuse to talk more about Hard Candy Christmas, which you did.
Awesome. that does not surprise me at all. I did follow through on crap. I've done much better on that sort of thing this year.
See, you're doing exactly what I intend to do at this time in 2013, which is say, yeah,
claim
I did that.
Success,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Example? You got an example at all, for example?
Yeah, what'd you follow through on?
I sort of led the development of the NPR Books Project.
There you go.
Count that
that's a
big
thing.
Kind of
a big thing. That's a wonderful project.
That's a thing for sure.
This year, I think, because I did not go back and listen to last year's podcast, I have the same resolutions this year that Stephen had last year. I've framed it a little differently. My resolution is that in my pop culture diet, I want a little less junk food and more solid nutrition. 2011 was a big year for a lot of pop culture junk food.
Excuse me, Trey just called it 2011.
I know I did. I want to make room in my life for the things that you and some of the listeners of the podcast have been enthusiastic about. I want to make room for things like Breaking Bad and The Good Wife. And that is without admitting that Rufus Wainwright's Carnegie Hall Judy Garland tribute has been sitting forlornly in my stack of Netflix.
Wait, how has your Netflix queue not imploded just through the sheer weight of the gayness of it?
It did catch fire briefly.
Yeah.
The stack of DVDs. For 9 freaking months, it's been sitting there on my coffee table.
Because you're never in the mood to watch a Judy Garland tribute?
Well,
bull frankly, hockey on that.
Well, it's one of those things I want to watch all at once, and it's like 2 hours. Yeah. And who has 2 hours anymore?
Okay.
And this being the point, when I'm home in the evenings, it's usually for a limited amount of time because I'm out doing other things, either with you people or at the theater or something else. So 2 hours is a big commitment. So I've been watching these smaller chunks. So maybe what I want to say is not less junk food, but less fewer small things so that I can make room for things that require a bit more commitment.
Hmm. Okay.
I think that's fair.
Linda Holmes, you had but the one resolution.
That's right.
It was the watchword for 2011 was going to be, do you remember?
Positivity.
In fact, what you said was you wanted to focus the majority of my energy on recommending and enjoying things that I like. How'd that go?
I think you did that.
I would say I did that. You know, it's always a mix, but I definitely did do a couple things this year that involved finding more stuff that I like that I wouldn't necessarily have found before. I went to Silver Docs and saw a bunch of documentaries that I wouldn't necessarily have found. I did focus, I think, more on recommending and less on digging through crap, although of course I say that on the day that I reviewed Work It.
Yep.
Which, I was going to say.
Which was pretty bad.
Yeah, you said you wanted to spend less time ripping a strip off of things, and Moa, you ripped a strip off that show. That was really fun.
Yeah, I still do it sometimes. Sure. I mean, as you said at the time, there's a place for that, and I would never want to completely stop doing
right.
that. But I think I did it up to a point.
Mm-hmm.
I think I did it up to a point.
Great. What about this year?
This year I'm going to be a little bit more concrete, since I was a little bit general last year. I saw this year about 70 2011 movie releases. And
that's it? It feels like you saw more.
This year's movies.
Yeah.
I saw about 70.
It's still 1.5 a week. That's
well, and you saw plenty of older movies in repertory.
Yes, absolutely. Right. That's true. I'm going to try to get that up to 100 this year. And of course, I'm not primarily a movie critic, at least not to the exclusion of other things. I have a whole bunch of, beats that I am trying to stay on top of. So it is tough to balance, but I'm going to try to push that up to 100 to 100 2012 movies. And I also, my big reading resolution is that I'm going to make myself finish The Marriage Plot, which has won all kinds of awards and which I am about halfway through and it is killing me.
Yeah.
It is like drinking poison. It's so unpleasant.
I think you should, as I did with that book, Angelology, I think you should live tweet it.
I understand that there are people who are massively huge fans of this. I am just struggling mightily, but I'm determined to do it because I have already read half of it. And I don't want to throw half of reading this book down the drain because that'll mean I read half of this book for nothing.
How long a book is it? Like how much
it's
of it?
It's not an extremely long book. I read it on my Kindle, so I have no idea how long it is.
It's 4,862 screens.
Yeah, specifically, what do you object to? Or is there any one thing you point to?
One of the things that frustrated me about Freedom was the expectation that I find every little emotional jot and tittle of the life of well-off East Coast intellectuals to be unbelievably fascinating.
Right.
And I just get to a point where I'm like, I don't care. These people are not that interesting, and what's happening to them is not that interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that they're very relatable to exactly the people who are going to buy the book.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it's very much satirizing the same people who are going to read the book, which to me is a very suspect enterprise and really makes it feel like it's a fake kind of satirizing.
Right.
Like
it's actually patting them on the head.
That you're sort of looking at this to say, like, well, I recognize these are the limitations of the way I live, but I'm going to live that way anyway.
Right.
And then there are other people who seem to think that the protagonist of this book is supposed to be sympathetic. Those people I cannot truck with at all. Because I constantly want to punch her in the face, and I have no idea where those people are coming from. But there are those people as well.
Okay.
It's been really tough, but I'm going to finish it because I believe in doing things like that and reading a certain amount of serious fiction, which is something I have not always done.
Mm-hmm. So that's your resolution?
Those are the big two, is to finish my
is to read a book I hate.
Finish my book and see more movies.
Okay, good. Last year I had two, one of which I really enjoyed, one of which I deeply regret. The one I really enjoyed was I said I'd go back and check out the show Cougar Town.
Yes, you did.
Yes, yay.
And man, that's a great show. It's a funny show. It is not the show that it was in its pilot, and people need to understand that if they don't already. Mm-hmm. And it really has found its legs, and ignore the title, and it's great.
Right.
Ignore the title is a big one.
As I think we have mentioned once before, it got to the show changed so much that it took to mocking its own title.
Right.
Because it knew that it was not the show it was when it began.
The one I deeply regret is saying that I would not abandon shows after one or two episodes, and that I would stick with them. I would open myself up and be more open and giving.
To be, you knew that was a mistake.
Yeah.
Knew that was a mistake.
And I have seen every freaking episode of Terra Nova, and I just, the feeling of resentment that descends with every new, it's like, well, maybe the next one's going to be better.
Yeah.
Maybe the next one's going to be better.
You are a stronger and better man than I am.
Yikes.
I watched every episode of Pan Am.
Man, that was really burned me. The resolution I have for this year, it's personal and it's boring, which in my case is redundant. And it has to do with going to the gym, and it's not really pop culture. And as listeners cannot partake in it, I do not consider it a popular culture resolution, therefore I will not bring it up on the show. Trigger.
Mockery of your not going to the gym.
The one that actually is remotely pop culture is the one, I don't know if I've mentioned this, but I'm writing a book.
Oh, good God.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it turns out I'm writing a book.
I did not know that.
It's a cultural history of Superman, and it's due with the publisher in April, and I'm right now on the year 1938. So I've got a day job I can't take time away from, and I've got a lot of writing projects I've put on hold, and there's so many video games I want to play that I can't touch. Skyrim, I can't wait to play Skyrim, and Batman Arkham City, I can't wait to play these games, but I can't touch them. But I do have something that the listeners can enjoy, can partake of, if they have a resolution that they're having trouble with.
Pre-ordering your book.
Well, that's A. B, have you guys heard of a program called Freedom?
No.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
This has been recommended to me by a lot of my friends who are full-time writers. It is a simple app in case of a Mac, or a program in the case of a PC that you can download, and you can tell it to disable the internet on your computer for anywhere up to 8 hours at a time.
I'm not doing that.
Now you say to me, Glenn, why would you go to the trouble of doing something like that? Why not just simply don't go on the internet?
No,
or just unplug your router? Well, if you're saying that to me, you have... Character, spine, rectitude, you have moral fiber.
Mm-hmm. Who's to say that?
And by the way, if you have moral fiber, it's a great way to keep your rectitude clean as a whistle.
Hey, now.
There are those of us who do not have any of those things need something like this. I tried it out today. It's a pain in the ass, because sometimes when you're typing...
Don't you need to research for your
This is the thing. Like, you know, now I have to kind of... Into the pros, I'm constantly saying, so in
1934,
19XX. Right, I just go on, and it's a pain. I didn't realize, but it is also, I mean, I cranked out more pages today than I have in a long time. So it is, it's for those of us who are weak-willed. I mean, I understand that this is Fall of Rome kind of stuff here.
I was going to say, you're being prepared for the internet apocalypse.
Right, exactly. This is like, how pampered do you have to be where you have to install a program to make your computer be less of a computer?
You need a manual typewriter.
But it's an amazing thing. It'll help you get work done. It's Freedom. It's an app.
I support you.
Thank you.
I'm not going to do it, but I support you.
No,
I support
you
in doing
it. Either.
Well, I'm glad to know that we all have our resolutions in place, and we'll come back in a year and judge each other. Harshly.
Yep.
Undoubtedly. Hopefully, Stephen will have read a book by then, maybe.
I think, you know what? I feel like this is my year.
As always, we will all...
Do or do not.
We will all try.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing we were going to talk about today is pop culture overload. Now, Stephen, you know a little bit about this. Can you talk a little bit about the origins of where we got this topic?
The idea for the segment came from our, I think it's fair to say, friend of Pop Culture Happy Hour, Andy Salzberg.
Mm-hmm.
A terrific writer. Used to be an Onion writer. Wrote a book that Linda cannot praise enough called Dear Old Love.
Dear Old Love.
And every once in a while, Andy pops in and does our job for us.
Right.
Which is always nice, in which he sends us ideas that are better than our own. And his idea in this case was to have us talk about the idea of pop culture overload, which is how do you handle the pieces of pop culture that you like but that demand a significant percentage of your life, whether it's in the form of a musician who dumps 6 albums worth of demos online,
right,
or a DVD that contains, you know, 2 bonus discs of, you know, interviews and whatnot. So the idea was to sort of go around the horn and sort of talk about how we as super fans of various things deal with just sort of the glut.
And I have heard a rumor, Stephen,
yes,
that our esteemed producer, Mike Katzoff, might have a contribution.
I hear that Mike occasionally writes for NPR Music.
Oh, I hear that too.
And I hear that there might have been some grumbling about a particular artist. Yeah. Who was getting under your skin there?
There's a few artists that I feel like are just incredibly prolific to the point where it has diminishing returns. One of them, I think, has been Prince, has sort of damaged a little bit of his legacy by...
Stopping putting out good records.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. I would imagine he probably, you know, every... record probably has a couple good songs on it.
Right.
You know, Ryan Adams, definitely comes to mind as someone who in the past has sort of put out way too much material for his own good. And some of that stuff is really good, but it gets overlooked. And the musician I always think about is actually Robert Pollard of the band Guided by Voices.
Yep.
And Guided by Voices was a band from the, what would you say, late 80s, early 90s for the most part?
Well into the 90s.
And they've put out a lot of beloved indie rock records that a lot of people particularly liked, mostly kind of in the mid-90s.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, he basically kicked out most of the members of the band, mm-hmm. and it basically just became the Robert Pollard solo project.
Right.
And he officially disbanded the band in 2004, but then from 2004 through this year, has put out 13 to 14 solo
Yeesh.
Recordings.
That is a lot.
That's a lot.
And some
and
of those are
lot.
Two and three in a year sometimes. And the reason this comes up is because last year, Guided by Voices got back together with sort of this classic lineup, and they've just now put out a record again for the first time since 2004.
It's called, was it Let's Go Eat the Factory?
Let's Go Eat the Factory. Yeah. As I think I said in my review, this recording is like every Guided by Voices record for good and for bad. It has a lot of good ideas on it. He's a guy who always constantly has 20 to 30, you know, ideas in his back pocket, but it also has a lot of unfinished ideas, yeah. too.
Yeah, he sort of tosses fragments mm-hmm. in lieu of songs. It's like, hey, I wrote a really, really good verse. Da-da-da-da. Okay, end song.
That's totally true. They peter out after a verse and a chorus, and I think for a lot of people, that's what makes it a Guided by Voices record or whatever. But some of my favorite stuff he's ever done is always the stuff that feels a little bit more refined, and maybe that's just my personal preference on pop music and rock music, is it feels a little bit more developed.
So what do you do about the fact that there's so much stuff? Do you sort of tune out of some of it after a while?
I think you have to tune out, because it's impossible to know which songs on which of these records are going to be worth hearing.
Yeah, you almost need a curator to handle your favorite band.
And unfortunately, the curator are people like me who are fans but have given up because
I was going to say, this is traditionally the function of a critic, the function of a music writer.
Oh, somebody sure,
gets
fine.
Gets paid to do this.
Sure.
To, you know, wade through all this stuff.
But I think...
But you're right, it gets harder and harder when the artist is moving the goalpost mm-hmm. and when the artist is not performing the act of curation that traditionally went into putting something like an album or a gallery collection together.
Particularly when the means of production were more expensive.
Exactly.
And the distribution channels were, yeah. were more complex.
Yep. Yeah, well, I mean, honestly, he was the preeminent lo-fi mm-hmm. four-track recording things so quickly because his mind just would make him do that. Now it's even easier because you don't have analog tape, you don't have to pay for duplication, you can just throw it up on the web. Mm-hmm. I think most of his stuff has been, you know, on CDs, but every artist now has the option of just throwing something up there.
Well, now you've got Bandcamp. I mean, you know, Mike, you're a big fan of Bradford Cox, who records as Deer Hunter and Atlas Sound, and he put up like a four CDs worth box set of his box set in quotes, digital box set, you know, of demos up online.
Yeah, and that was like after a solo recording, and his band Deer Hunter had already put out a record. So he basically put out like six albums last year.
As I recall, I mean, you're still a big, big fan of his. And I think that it's interesting how some of these musicians, after a while, it's like they break the listener. It's like they make it almost impossible for the listener to re-engage in any way. And I think that's the interesting phenomenon in terms of music, the musical side of this discussion, mm-hmm. is I used to love Ryan Adams. Like, I just used to, I mean, oh my God, Heartbreaker, such a great record. And now, it's like I've been carried down this vast river of music, and now I just can't even, it's like, forget it, I can't even swim back to shore and reconnect
with it. I mean, in his defense, I think he has pared back a little bit.
I feel like he's hogging my time.
Here's the difference, I think, between someone like this Bradford Cox Deer Hunter guy and someone like Robert Pollard, is that Bradford Cox puts stuff on the internet for the truest of true fans. It's free. You don't have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
You can buy in. I mean, not literally buy in. There's nothing to buy. You can choose to go and seek this out.
Acquire the data.
And then he also kind of curates and picks his best songs and puts out an actual record that you spend money on. This past year, Atlas Sound put out a record, and I think one or two of those songs came from that big collection of demos that came out the year before. He took a couple of those and actually refined them into something. Then those demos are just that. They're just demos that pull up the veil.
So then they become like you buy a DVD and it's got a bonus disc. And 5/6 of the people buying that 2-disc DVD set probably don't even touch the second disc.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the DVD commentary of what he does.
Yeah.
Where Robert Pollard is just putting out stuff and putting out stuff. I don't want to say he is compulsive, but it feels like a compulsive need as a critic and someone who is a fan, too.
All right, I have a slightly related question, because I was thinking about this in terms of the people that I love, and they're not musicians. I don't think it has to do necessarily with volume of output. For me, it has to do with specificity of vision. So, for example, somebody like Guy Madden, the Canadian film director I've talked about before, the comic book creator Daniel Clowes.
Oh, love Clowes.
I love them both, but they are both so singular. What they produce is, and they're not particularly prolific. They're not particularly prolific. Madden has been recently doing a lot of short films, but there's something so singular about their approach that once you see them over and over again, even though you love what they do, the tone is so similar that the tics that they have, that these artists have, become noticeable, and then they become eventually enervating. Is that kind of related to what you guys are talking about?
You mentioned the comics writer Dan Clowes. And I guess there was a time, you know, when I was getting everything that Fantagraphics was putting out, and every time something of Clowes's came in, I would just sort of greedily and hungrily devour it in the most melancholy fashion possible.
Right.
I never really tired of his vision because he sort of pursued it in enough different forms. It was always sort of punching you in the heart, but it wasn't necessarily, I didn't necessarily find it numbing.
Right. I don't think it's the artist's responsibility to constantly be changing up their vision. The artist has the vision, and you respond to it or you don't. And I still love his stuff. It's just that I go to it and my expectations are met. My expectations of a certain tone, of a certain bleak, mordant sense of humor are met almost. He can continue to surprise, and I'm talking about a lot of artists, not just Clowes's representative of many, but they can continue to surprise, but they surprise in the same way.
I sort of looked at this from even another point of view, which was my longstanding affection for reading Stephen King. It's not just that he's prolific, although he is certainly prolific. But even when you take into account that there have been a couple of breaks, he put out less stuff for a while, after he had his accident. But the thing about him is, if you're a fan of his stuff, every time something comes out, it is a big project to read. For instance, he has this new book out about time travel and the JFK assassination, which has been very, very well reviewed.
But it's massive.
And when I went to dive into it, you know, I bought it on my Kindle and I downloaded it. And it's a little bit easier because at least on the Kindle, I'm not carrying the physical book.
Right.
But when you are, when you realize how massive it is and how long it's going to take to read, when you are a fan of somebody, you feel like you want to read everything, but it is such a big project. It becomes such a big investment every time.
Exactly this experience over the weekend. My delightful husband bought me the 2-volume Stephen Sondheim memoirs. It's not really a memoir. It's a collection of his lyrics with associated a series of commentaries and anecdotes and grudges and heresies, I think, is one of the words in the subtitle.
Yeah, I haven't seen the second one, but I have the first one.
Trey, don't leave that book anywhere near the Rufus Wainwright, Judy Garland.
They live right on opposite sides of the room because I wouldn't want you know, cold fusion to happen or anything. So I packed these books in my bag on the way back from the Florida holiday vacation. My bag was overweight. I had to take it out. It was seven pounds of books. But I'm having exactly the same sort of feeling about that. Not only is it just a gigantically heavy book to pick up and read, even one of them, the first volume comes with three separate introductions, sort of laying the ground rules and the principles of the discussion. And I'm like, okay, let me in the door a little more easily, will you, sir? But I'm devoted to it.
It's a big task. And that's a little bit how I feel about reading Stephen King, is that there are certain things. I have not read all of his stuff by any means. There was probably a time in my somewhat younger life when I would have predicted that I always would read all of it, and I always would be really super excited about
it.
But
you didn't, back then, you didn't know about his Entertainment Weekly columns.
Well, there's that.
But. Well, also, I used to read every Stephen King book that came out. I stopped a while ago because I started to notice the tics. One tic was that when scary stuff happens, the italics come out. Does that he still do that?
Yeah, of course. Okay. Of course, sure. And I think that you do notice tics, and that's one of the things that's nice about taking a little time away from somebody. Because I think no matter how good you are as a performer or a writer or whatever, you do have those things. And we've had this conversation sometimes about doing this show where if you listen to yourself too much, you hear yourself use the same expressions and things like that.
Sort of.
I never do that.
Yeah.
No. So, I have no such tics.
So no matter what no matter how hard you try, everybody has their little things that they do. And I think when you're writing for 1,000 pages at a time, it's hard to get to the end of 1,000 pages without feeling like you've seen a lot of that routine. It's the same thing. If you read all of the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo books all together, mm-hmm. you start to be like, yeah. Pretty much every time the woman comes on the scene, I know how she's going to react to the guy because it's the way every woman reacts to him, which is, right. I desperately must sleep with you right now.
I had the same, the same thing with the Game of Thrones books, which mm-hmm. I devoured all together in one sitting. And you learned the rhythms of those, you know, of that kind of scene setting, and you knew you could feel when a chapter was going to end two pages before it did. And
but I think that's this
you
is
learned
part
to
of the
skip the descriptions of the feasts because it was just a list of ingredients.
But isn't it also part of the appeal? The book starts to feel like a familiar. It's like talking to a friend, and the friend sort of has certain almost like you have inside jokes or inside references with
there's
that.
Certainly
but
some
I,
of that.
You know, to return to the question of how do you address this? How do you address this overload that was our starting premise? Mm-hmm. Linda got to one of the things that I was going to bring up, which is you just have to give things up for Lent. Mm-hmm. You have to stop mm-hmm. with something that you're fascinated with. Mm-hmm. Move on to something else. And it won't come as a surprise that when you go back to that thing, it mm-hmm. will be freshly wonderful.
I feel exactly that way about the whole genre of superhero comics. Mm-hmm. I don't call it giving it up for Lent, but I call it cycling in and out. I will mm-hmm. go and be engaged with this genre, which is nothing but tics. Let's be honest. It's nothing but very
even
familiar tropes.
Even when it's not the tick?
Even when it's not the tick. But after a while there, you just start to feel that what this genre has to say, you've uh-huh. heard said. Uh-huh. And then you kind of cycle onto somebody who's inverting the genre and commenting on it in crazy new ways. Then you realize that everybody's commenting on it in the same crazy new ways they commented on it 10 years ago. So you just cycle in and out, and I'm on kind of in a refractory period right now with superhero comics, as we said.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing, obviously, is that when you get into an environment that is as super saturated as ours is, obviously your social networks are one of the filters that you use, right?
Yeah.
The function that used to be only the function of the media and or the critical class is now performed to one degree or another by your social networks. And you learn who you can trust, mm-hmm. right? And it's rather like reading a favorite critic.
I mean, I count on my movie critic friends to tell me, for example, when a Woody Allen movie is actually worth seeing.
Right?
Because it's like 1 in 8. You know, it's sort of these interchangeable, you know, slight comedies with completely interchangeable titles. Yeah. And then one of them actually is supposed to be good, then I'll try it out and see
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
The problem with social media is that it's as much a problem as a cure, because frankly, the flip side of that is you people. I don't know how to say this, but you people are part of the problem. You know, you talk too much on the Twitter, and you follow interesting people whom
of course.
Have now also followed. It's gotten to the point where I've become one of those people who gets scolded at the dinner table for trying to keep up.
Well, you have to take a little bit of responsibility, I think, for
there is that
filtering just, for yourself.
Or just download Freedom. Yep. I'm done.
Freedom.
Download Freedom, turn off the internet.
Or if you can, is there an app that will actually turn off your loved ones?
That's what I'm shopping for.
It's called Twitter.
I'm thinking about one right now, as a matter of fact. Well, I think that probably wraps up.
Speaking of overload.
So our final segment this week is the same final segment we have every week, which is what is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, you want to kick us off? What's making you happy this week?
Well, first of all, you know, speaking of, we were talking about resolutions, and I said that before our little break, I said that I was going to spend our break watching Parks and Rec, and instead spent it watching The Amazing Race Australia.
Oh.
Now, first of all, I like the idea that this is sort of setting 2012 as the year of broken promises.
Mm-hmm.
but also, wish to point out, and I know that, Linda, you will back me up, that The Amazing Race Australia, if you can acquire it through means, mm-hmm. is awesome.
It is awesome.
And seriously, like, better than the last 8 seasons of
great.
That show.
It's great.
Really? Would you agree with that, Trent?
Yes.
Yeah? How about that?
Would.
Huh? And,
I would agree.
And Linda is like an Amazing Race scholar.
I know.
I would.
That's why I asked.
The Amazing Race Australia, because the Amazing Race goes all over the place, right?
It
starts in Australia.
It's produced for Australian television. It has Australian people, and it goes around.
Okay. Because I was really sort of looking for, you know, a kind of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert style race with challenges,
including
dingoes chasing them.
Just try it.
Basically, think of a really good season of The Amazing Race. Imagine it with awesome accents.
Yeah.
And you got it.
Fair.
They go all the way around the world. It's for, I guess, like, you know, it's for a little less
money. I think
money.
They actually don't. I think they make a circle and come back.
It's close enough.
But it's close
it's like
enough.
40,000 miles.
They certainly travel about the world.
It does not seem like some, not to be an overseas reality TV scholar, but you know, some of them really are writ small, and this is not, and it's a wonderful cast, and I just loved it.
It was great.
And pounding it down in one big glob while cleaning the basement certainly made me happy. Saw some good movies, you know, some of which we will be talking about on this podcast. Did see The Descendants, but I can't say it made me happy so much as a blubbering wreck. And yeah, and also I guess the Rose Bowl, which taught me how to feel pain again.
Yeah. Wisconsin did not win.
No, they did not.
The Rose Bowl. We're just going to leave it at that.
No, wow. Not. I'd like to congratulate our Oregonian listeners.
Depths of my not caring.
Off Wisconsin.
Right. Yeah, that's what I did
there. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
Well, what is making me happy this week is the discovery that during my holiday vacation, which consisted chiefly of gross overeating and promiscuous oversleeping and nephew-oriented conversations about things like boogers and farts, my brain did not totally atrophy. Because just last night, I actually made a little progress on the sort of more solid nutrition resolution. Last night, I watched, from start to finish, in all its glory, The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, which is another thing that had been sitting in my Netflix stack, because it is not widely available on streaming video. You actually have to get them to mail you the DVD. But I am here to tell you that it is worth it.
That's just such an outrage.
It is.
I have to rely upon the postal service to deliver it to my house.
Postal service. This is a really strange, but also really extraordinary movie musical from 1964. If you have not seen it, please go and watch it. It's the breakout movie for Catherine Deneuve. It also stars a creature called Nino Castelnuovo, who is rather comely, but bland as a board. The one criticism I have of this film, or one of the major criticisms I have of the film, is that in the Love Duet, which is a rather famous piece of music, he's sitting there in a cafe with his arm around the most beautiful woman in the world, who was like 21 years old at the time, and he looks like he's trying to pass a kidney stone while simultaneously putting her shoulder back into its socket.
Yikes. This is the Zach Braff rule.
Right.
Being miserable while surrounded by beauty.
Yes, right. The movie has gotten a little bit of bump in conversation about it in the last week or so, because Edgar Wright, the guy who made, you know, Hot Fuzz and Shaun of the Dead and Scott Pilgrim and all of those movies, he programmed it at a movie screening series that he does. He picked it because apparently recently he's been talking about a script he's been writing for a movie musical, and people keep mentioning this film to him, and he'd never seen it. So Edgar Wright and I recommend The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, and it's just color saturated, gorgeous. It's really ambitious, completely sung through.
I have to say, I am completely shocked because Stephen is nodding like he knows
movie. Yeah, right.
I own this movie, and among other things, Keith Phipps, editor of the AV Club, will tell you this is his favorite movie of all time.
It's the story is a story that would be considered in any other movie oversimplistic. It's a very, very straightforward story about love and fidelity in a time of war. Right. Mm.
The Umbrellas of Cherbourg poster was the only poster that hung in the AV Club office that did not have like a chimp on it.
There you go. Perfect. Thank you, Trey Graham. Excellent choice. Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
On December 29th, 2011, there appeared on the Twitter an account by the name of Critic Michiko. Kaketani is the fiction book critic for the New York Times, perhaps the most powerful fiction critic in the world, certainly read by the most powerful people in the American publishing industry. The bio that appeared underneath her photo, just hanging out, limning about books. Now this is a fake Twitter account, and Kaketani has gotten some criticism over the years for using the word limn a lot. Things are often limned in her reviews. But the tone of this thing is pitch perfect. For example, the reader waits in vain for anyone to arrive and pat the bunny. The boredom of waiting, though perhaps the author's intent is maudlin. That's one tweet. It is with frustration that the reader tries to affix the new Swiffer pad to the Swiffer base. The user's manual is self-indulgent blather. Well, New Year's Eve is approaching. Looking for someone to hang out, chill, maybe explicate some phenomena together. And my absolute favorite one, you know how critics will link to link to their review? Uh-huh. This person did, here's my review in the New York Times, and it linked to an Amazon page for an actual book poorly translated from the Japanese, whose title is How to Goodbye Depression If You Constrict Anus 100 Times Every Day. Malarkey? Question mark. Or Effective Way? Question mark.
What?
So the speculation started up, is this Ron Charles of the Washington Post doing this? Is it Colson Whitehead? Ron Charles denied it. Colson Whitehead has not today. Could be anybody. But then the plot got even thicker on January 1st, when there appeared on the Twitter an account by the name of Actual NYTMK, which just created an account and at replied to critic Michiko saying, please stop impersonating me. I am me. Which has a nice plaintive quality to it. And then, I understand the joke, but please, enough is enough. And so then, now there's a back and forth on, is this new person actually Michiko Kakurai? Because she has not admitted to it, and people have called her up and asked, is this you? And she's not responding. Although she does occasionally respond to other people who are like, hey, is this really you? And she'll say, I am only here to put a stop to this absurd derivative fiction, which kind of sounds like her. I assure you, I am not here to amuse anyone.
if that is a second level of parody, then it is possibly the most awesome meta-commentary I've
ever
seen.
That is exactly the point. I have no idea. I have no idea what's going on here. It could be the same person just going back and forth, but whatever is going on here, it's still going on as of Tuesday this week. It is some deeply weird meta fictional reality, the likes of which has never been seen before, so I'm eating it up. You can start by looking at Critic Michiko, M-I-C-H-I-K-O, on Twitter.
Excellent. Glenn Weld and I will have to enjoy that particular parody account, which I've not checked out yet.
Only like 300, 400 people have.
After this podcast, man, we're going to hit 450.
All right. Well, I will be one of the first to check it out. What is making me happy this week, I had a lovely, lovely trip out of town for New Year's. I was in Boston with friends, and one of the things that I did while I was up there was watch The Amazing Race Australia. Mm-hmm. But another thing I did while I was up there was I checked out my screeners of the new Downton Abbey, which will be premiering the second season on PBS on Sunday, the 8th of January. And I have seen the first several hours, and despite the fact that there have been some people who have taken the position that it's not that good, I actually really enjoyed it. I actually thought the second season is a lot of fun. There are a few what I would consider sort of false hallways to wander down that I don't care about that much. But it still is the show that it was when it delighted everybody so much. It still has wonderful, wonderful Maggie Smith one-liner.
How is there not a Dowager Countess Twitter account yet?
I don't know. That's a great question. It still has enormously charming, you know, romantic, thwarted relationships and things like that. And it's
prim women in hats.
It is, but prim women in hats.
Yes,
it's beautiful. It's a different tone because it's taking place during World War I, and so you know there is great sacrifice and there is hardship and. Things like that, but I actually really
slightly stale scones.
I actually really was enjoying it, and I definitely recommend it. So, what's making me happy this week is a little early look at the new season of Downton Abbey. Which, if you're in the UK, you've already seen a long time ago, so you don't understand why we're so slow. And many of you who are listening to this podcast, because I know who you are. You librarians have already obtained this
through questionable means,
and you've seen it too, but. For everyone else who's following the rules, it'll start this Sunday. And that's what's making me happy.
Yay.
And that brings us to the end of our show for our first show in 2012.
Yay.
You can follow...
The look on the face was a good look on the face.
You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. Be sure to tell him, welcome to 2012. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, and Graham like Graham Nash, I'm going to say this week.
Well done.
You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. And if you want to talk about Guided by Voices or anything else exciting like that, you can follow our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff. That's Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music. You are chair dancing to it right now. Thanks to all of you guys for being here once again after the holiday
so
break.
So glad to be back. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for being here, and we will see you back here next week.